The Life Divine. Chapter 1. The Human Aspiration. She follows to the goal of those that are passing on beyond. She is the first in the eternal succession of the dawns that are coming. Usha widens, bringing out that which lives, awakening someone who is dead. What is her scope when she harmonizes with the dawns that shone out before and those that now must shine? She desires the ancient mornings and fulfills their light. Projecting forwards her illumination, she enters into communion with the rest that are to come. Kutsa Angirasa, Rig Veda. Threefold are those supreme births of this divine force that is in the world. They are true, they are desirable. He moves there, wide overt, within the infinite, and shines pure, luminous, and fulfilling. That which is immortal in mortals and possessed of the truth is a God and established inwardly as an energy working out in our divine powers. Become high uplifted, O strength, pierce all veils, manifest in us the things of the Godhead. Vamadeva, Rig Veda. The earliest preoccupation of man in his awakened thoughts, and as it seems his inevitable and ultimate preoccupation, for it survives the longest periods of skepticism and returns after every banishment, is also the highest which his thought can envisage. It manifests itself in the divination of Godhead, the impulse towards perfection, the search after pure truth and unmixed bliss, the sense of a secret immortality. The ancient dawns of human knowledge have left us their witness to this constant aspiration. Today, we see a humanity satiated but not satisfied by victorious analysis of the externalities of nature, preparing to return to its primeval longings. The earliest formula of wisdom promises to be its last: God, light, freedom, immortality. These persistent ideals of the race are at once the contradiction of its normal experience and the affirmation of higher and deeper experiences which are abnormal to humanity and only to be attained in their organized entirety by a revolutionary individual effort or an evolutionary general progression. To know, possess, and be the divine being in an animal and egoistic consciousness, to convert our twilight or obscure physical mentality into the plenary supramental illumination, to build peace and a self-existent bliss where there is only a stress of transitory satisfactions besieged by physical pain and emotional suffering, to establish an infinite freedom in a world which presents itself as a group of mechanical necessities, to discover and realize the immortal life in a body subjected to death and constant mutation. This is offered to us as the manifestation of God in matter and the goal of nature in her terrestrial evolution. To the ordinary material intellect, which takes its present organization of consciousness for the limit of its possibilities, the direct contradiction of the unrealized ideals with the realized fact is a final argument against their validity. But if we take a more deliberate view of the world's workings, that direct opposition appears rather as part of nature's profoundest method and the seal of her completest sanction. For all problems of existence are essentially problems of harmony. They arise from the perception of an unsolved discord and the instinct of an undiscovered agreement or unity, To rest content with an unsolved discord is possible for the practical and more animal part of man, but impossible for his fully awakened mind. And usually, even his practical parts only escape from the general necessity, either by shutting out the problem or by accepting a rough, utilitarian, and unillumined compromise. For essentially, all nature seeks a harmony. Life and matter in their own sphere, as much as mind in the arrangement of its perceptions. The greater the apparent disorder of the materials offered, or the apparent disparateness, even to irreconcilable opposition of the elements that have to be utilized, the stronger is the spur, and it drives towards a more subtle and puissant order than can normally be the result of a less difficult endeavor. The accordance of active life with a material form in which the condition of activity itself seems to be inertia is one problem of opposites that nature has solved and seeks always to solve better with greater complexities, for its perfect solution would be the material immortality of a fully organized, mind-supporting animal body. The accordance of conscious mind and conscious will with a form and a life in themselves not overtly self-conscious and capable at best of a mechanical or subconscious will is another problem of opposites in which she has produced astonishing results and aims always at higher marvels. For there, her ultimate miracle would be an animal consciousness no longer seeking, but possessed of truth and light, with the practical omnipotence which would result from the possession of a direct and perfected knowledge. Not only, then, is the upward impulse of man towards the accordance of yet higher opposites rational in itself, but it is the only logical completion of a rule and an effort that seem to be a fundamental method of nature and the very sense of her universal strivings. We speak of the evolution of life in matter, the evolution of mind in matter. But evolution is a word which merely states the phenomenon without explaining it, for there seems to be no reason why life should evolve out of material elements or mind out of living form, unless we accept the Vedantic solution that life is already involved in matter and mind in life, because in essence, matter is a form of veiled life, life a form of veiled consciousness. And then there seems to be little objection to a farther step in the series, and the admission that the mental consciousness may itself be only a form and a veil of higher states which are beyond mind. In that case, the unconquerable impulse of man towards God, light, bliss, freedom, immortality, presents itself in its right place in the chain as simply the imperative impulse by which nature is seeking to evolve beyond mind, and appears to be as natural, true, and just as the impulse towards life which she has planted in certain forms of matter, or the impulse towards mind which she has planted in certain forms of life. As there, so here, the impulse exists more or less obscurely in her different vessels with an ever-ascending series in the power of its will to be. As there, so here, it is gradually evolving and bound fully to evolve the necessary organs and faculties. As the impulse towards mind ranges from the more sensitive reactions of life in the metal and the plant up to its full organization in man, so in man himself there is the same ascending series, the preparation, if nothing more, of a higher and divine life. The animal is a living laboratory in which nature has, it is said, worked out man. Man himself may well be a thinking and living laboratory in whom and with whose conscious cooperation she wills to work out the Superman, the God, or, shall we not say rather, to manifest God. For if evolution is the progressive manifestation by nature of that which slept or worked in her, involved, it is also the overt realization of that which she secretly is. We cannot then bid her pause at a given stage of her evolution, nor have we the right to condemn with the religionist as perverse and presumptuous, or with the rationalist as a disease or hallucination, any intention she may evince or effort that she may make to go beyond. If it be true that spirit is involved in matter, and apparent nature is secret God, then the manifestation of the divine in himself and the realization of God within and without are the highest and most legitimate aim possible to man upon earth. Thus, the eternal paradox and eternal truth of a divine life in an animal body, an immortal aspiration or reality inhabiting a mortal tenement, a single and universal consciousness representing itself in limited minds and divided egos, a transcendent, indefinable, timeless, and spaceless being who alone renders time and space and cosmos possible, and in all these the higher truth realizable by the lower term, justify themselves to the deliberate reason as well as to the persistent instinct or intuition of mankind. Attempts are sometimes made to have done finally with questionings which have so often been declared insoluble by logical thought, and to persuade men to limit their mental activities to the practical and immediate problems of their material existence in the universe. But such evasions are never permanent in their effect. Mankind returns from them with a more vehement impulse of inquiry, or a more violent hunger for an immediate solution. By that hunger, mysticism profits, and new religions arise to replace the old that have been destroyed or stripped of significance by a skepticism which itself could not satisfy because, although its business was inquiry, it was unwilling sufficiently to inquire. The attempt to deny or stifle a truth because it is yet obscure in its outward workings and too often represented by obscurantist superstition or a crude faith is itself a kind of obscurantism. The will to escape from a cosmic necessity because it is arduous, difficult to justify by immediate tangible results, slow in regulating its operations, must turn out eventually to have been no acceptance of the truth of nature, but a revolt against the secret, mightier will of the Great Mother. It is better and more rational to accept what she will not allow us as a race to reject, and lift it from the sphere of blind instinct, obscure intuition, and random aspiration into the light of reason and an instructed and consciously self-guiding will. And if there is any higher light of illumined intuition or self-revealing truth, which is now in man either obstructed and inoperative, or works with intermittent glancings as if from behind a veil, or with occasional displays as of the northern lights in our material skies, then there also we need not fear to aspire. For it is likely that such is the next higher state of consciousness, of which mind is only a form and veil, and through the splendors of that light may lie the path of our progressive self-enlargement into whatever highest state is humanity's ultimate resting place. This is the original edition of The Life Divine, published as a book in 1939, and it says in its inscription, "To Kapali, with blessings, Sri Aurobindo." We're blessed to have this book with us. I won't wear it out. I'll wear this one out. We in the center have waited a long time to pick up the Life Divine for a study. A study which we've only attempted once before, and that on Saturday afternoons at 3 o'clock, where we enjoyed the enchantment of a number of people, bright souls, who came to read line by line the words of Sri Aurobindo and to discuss what those lines meant. These Sunday nights we've reserved primarily over the years for materials which we thought were pragmatic, which would help us in the practice of the integral yoga of Sri Aurobindo and the Mother. But we have agreed to take this up because the Life Divine is a record in rational form of Sri Aurobindo's inner yogic experiences. And as such, call us, or call to us in a different way, the realities that those experiences represent. In other words, as we study these passages, if we are open, we will feel the pressing of those energies and those states of consciousness upon us from above, opening up within us to emerge. And so I suggest that there will be a practical dimension to our study of the Life Divine. This first chapter, The Human Aspiration, which we just read aloud from beginning to end, is the only one that we could probably read aloud from beginning to end in the compass of a single evening. Oh, the second and third are relatively short as well. I concur. But to hear the magic of his words, even read so poorly as by this fellow, is worth it, I think. Now, let's back up and look again at the first chapter. I think we noted that on the 25th of June in 1914, Sri Aurobindo made a note in his private diary that this essay had come, and he had written it in great clarity and rapidity. I think it bears mentioning again, too, that when Sri Aurobindo recast the Life Divine, he made minor changes, major additions to many chapters, wrote entirely new chapters to flesh out his vision. But whenever he looked again and again at the first chapter, he found it to be fine, just as it was. Clear. I think we are allowed to say something that he would never say, that it is inspired, directly transmitted from a higher consciousness onto the printed page. So, The Human Aspiration begins with a pair of mottos. That's what Sri Aurobindo called these Vedic and Upanishadic citations that we'll meet at the beginning of every chapter. The first one is from a rishi whose name is Kutsa Angirasa. Angirasa, by itself, connotes a family devoted to the mystic fire, to Agni. Kutsa we meet often in the Rig Veda, and in one place he travels upwards with the god of the divine mind, Indra, until they reach the plenitude of being which is natural to Indra. And so much has Kutsa been identified with the god, so much does the same blood flow through both, that none can tell them apart, except for Indra's wife, who knows immediately the difference. She can distinguish. But it's an idea in Kutsa, in his life, in what he achieved in his inner being, that we are to soar and become one with the divine above. But Kutsa always returns to the earth. Here, in this citation from the first book of the Rig Veda, I think it's the 113th hymn, which is devoted to Usha, the dawn, we see something that is perfectly apposite, not only to the opening of the life divine, the idea that the dawn is rising, bringing that illumination, but appears in Sri Aurobindo's great epic poem as well, Savitri. Savitri opens with the dawn. Savitri also closes with the dawn. Dawn after dawn, dawn succeeding dawn is the image. Until finally there is a permanent dawn. That permanent dawn would be the supramental age, which we aspire for, the human aspiration. She follows to the goal of those that are passing on beyond. She is the first in the eternal succession of the dawns that are coming. Usha widens, bringing out that which lives, awakening someone who was dead. What is her scope when she harmonizes with the dawns that shone out before and those that now must shine? She desires the ancient mornings and fulfills their light. Projecting forwards her illumination, she enters into communion with the rest that are to come. So the idea is that this light is born in us and has its fulfillment in the day as it grows. Then, having spent that illumination, there is a cycling back. And when darkness comes, it isn't a full covering up of the light, it isn't a loss of the light, but it is a period of digestion, of assimilation. And the previous dawn is followed by the next dawn, which, remembering the past, carries all that was experienced before with it, pointing always towards the future. So there is this constant motion of progress that the dawn suggests is available to us, natural to the manifestation, key to the cosmos. The second one is from Vamadeva. It's from the fourth book, an even older book than the first. And it really is an invocation of Agni, the mystic fire, the sacrificial flame. It says, threefold are those supreme births of this divine force that is in the world. They are true, they are desirable. Those three fold aspects of him which are born above, we would call in succeeding ages Sat-Chit-Ananda. True being, true consciousness, true delight. And it says, he moves there wide overt within the infinite and shines pure, luminous, and fulfilling. So the Agni that we have here, up there, moves fully liberated, does not have to be ignited, because it is always alive, always aware, delighted, sure of itself and its steps. But here is the question for us. What do we do with Agni? That which is immortal in mortals and possessed of the truth is a god and established inwardly as an energy working out in our divine powers. This is that same Agni manifest here. He's not only on the sacrificial altar, but he's inside of us, and he stirs us into activity. And with his energy, pushes into manifestation all the potentialities that lie within us. So they can't rest undiscovered, untapped. Agni stimulates us, pushes us. So we invoke him and say, become high uplifted, O strength, rise up in us. Rise up, be strong. Pierce all veils, all the obscurities that meet us, level after level as we aspire, have to be burnt up. The smoke has to be cleared away as the flame consumes the fuel. Manifest in us the things of the Godhead. So bring out all that is within. So the idea of an eternal succession of dawns, the idea of this immortal stationed within our mortal being that wants to manifest all of our potentials leads us to these first sentences of Sri Aurobindo. He's chosen them well. The earliest preoccupation of man in his awakened thoughts, and as it seems, his inevitable and ultimate preoccupation, is also the highest which his thought can envisage. So this is a Vedic assonance. This, in India, would be the old Vedic knowledge. In other climes, in other parts of the world, it may also have had its own iteration, but it would be similar in theme, because it is built in the human, whether we use the Sanskrit language to express it or some other language. This aspiration towards this formula that he uncovers for us, God, light, freedom, immortality, is the same, irrepressible. And they're persistent ideals. They are perhaps not satisfied in the normal rounds of our life, but in their organized entirety, he says, they can be attained by a revolutionary individual effort or an evolutionary general progression. The revolutionary effort is, of course, yoga, where we become volitional. We apply our will and intentionally, forcefully advance beyond the confines of what limits us. Never satisfied with what we've done, we always push farther. If you're any good at yoga, that's what you do. Or the evolutionary general progression is the slow method which nature takes, which carries us, presenting to us experience after experience. Whatever that web of experience is, we digest it. And even if we are not aspiring with the force of a yogin, still we move forward. The waves of evolution carry us commonly forward. But that takes eons. In yoga, we can achieve in the span of a life a great change of consciousness, introduce to the world new powers and awarenesses, new energies, and keep within our view possibilities which seem to the person bound by materiality to be fanciful or impossible. But just as when Sri Aurobindo was writing in the Isha Upanishad, in his commentary, calling our attention to how the Upanishad poses to the mind these oppositions of the divine and nature. This oppositional pole is part of nature's greater method. It is a profound method that seals her completest sanction. We can't rest until we've answered the greatest question. Nature is looking for harmony. All problems of existence are problems of harmony, Sri Aurobindo says. So where we find oppositions within ourselves, between the immortal that's within us and what seems to be a death-bound vehicle, our bodies, which have a terminus, have an end, or whether it's the individual struggling against social confines, or whether it's the limitation of the ego trying to find absorption into a transcendent reality that washes clear of all boundaries. All of these things speak to us about something that is attainable, because every opposition in nature is a clue to what may be impossible now but will be possible tomorrow. We think, when we look at a discord, we think, when we have our hopes dashed by an effort which fails to succeed, that that's the end of the business. But to nature, it is the beginning of a series of efforts. And Sri Aurobindo brings us back to the idea that the sophistication with which nature arranges a solution to a problem and then betters it again and again, takes a beginning victory, compounds, multiplies, adds sophistication and subtlety to it. Something that he's writing about in 1914, Ilya Prigozhin received, I believe, a Nobel Prize for, in formulating what's something that he called dissipative structuring, which means when an open system is challenged from outside and its very existence is in question, it can throw itself into a new, more delicate, but more complete answer to the challenge and arrive at a still different system which will actually resolve all the old dilemmas and provide a new synthesis. So not only is the threat of demise erased, but there is a new richness and a new forward momentum. So Sri Aurobindo, 60 years before, put it in plain English. The accordance of active life with the material of form, in which the condition of activity itself seems to be inertia, is one problem of opposites that nature has solved and seeks always to solve better with greater complexities, for its perfect solution would be the material immortality of a fully organized mind-supporting animal body. the context of the challenge there. But next, the accordance of conscious mind and conscious will with the form and life in themselves, not overtly self-conscious and capable at best of a mechanical or subconscious will, is another problem of opposites in which she has produced astonishing results and aims always at higher marvels. So, in other words, in each iteration, you begin with the seeming denial, but with the ultimate victory, the erasure of the problem and the provided solution. So not only then is the upward impulse of man towards the accordance of yet higher opposites rational in itself, but it is the only logical completion of a rule and an effort that seem to be a fundamental method of nature in the very sense of her universal strivings. And then he takes up the great question of evolution. We speak of the evolution of life and matter, the evolution of mind and matter, but evolution is a word which merely states the phenomenon without explaining it. And he moves to the Vedantic solution that all that we seem to be aspiring for is already involved here. There has been a cosmic involution of divine being, an investment of what is eternal and immortal and true being and true consciousness and true delight in all the grades of existence in that descending staircase that lead to the enclosure of matter. It is pre-existent in matter. It is involved in matter. So life, already being present, can, in certain material combinations, evoke, admit the presence, the stirring of life. And life, in certain organizations, can admit the stirring of mind. But always, it's the appearance within, the appearance of something without, of something which exists within, I think is the better way to express it. So, he is adumbrating in each of these sentences things that he will express in huge chapters. The idea that this aspiration is built evolutionarily into us requires a prior involutionary descent, and a descent of real being which seems to mask itself so that it can, in a sense, get started in the world and then will progressively reveal itself. And all the grades of existence that we find in the world are obviously present in us, and as the human is the conscious representative of nature, when they appear and evolve in us, then in a sense it liberates the entire principle of that for the rest of nature as well. So there is a staircase of light that we build up as we grow. And as we grow upwards, each element of power and light that emerges has a greater downward reach. So life fundamentally restructures matter. But mind, operating in living matter, reaches even deeper. And if this supramental consciousness that he mentions in the second paragraph, if that manifests, then the reach is complete, because that, being a new and transcendent element, has the capacity to cut through all veils and reach the very core of the beginnings of the cosmos without losing its station above. Mind does not remember where it came from. Life does not remember its origining in the power of Chit Shakti. But They will, when the supermind manifests through them. So we don't listen to the religionist who thinks that our goals are extravagant and we should be content with living a good moral life and going to a distant heaven after our passing. We won't listen to the rationalist who can't be convinced that what isn't present right now can never be. Rather, we're going to work in collaboration with nature and with its evolutionary power to resolve this eternal paradox. The lower term can realize the higher term. Matter can realize existence. Life can realize its oneness with Chit Shakti, as Sri Aurobindo will reveal later. Mind can live in oneness as an expressive tool and instrument of a supramental consciousness. And the soul, that drop of bliss which is core to each of us, is that which represents the Supreme Person and tastes the delight of the whole cosmic enterprise for him. So we can't listen to the naysayers, whether they come from the fields of religion or the fields of physical science. We have to go forward because we feel this aspiration, this need to make life immortal, to make the body divine. The will to escape from a cosmic necessity. So again, there is a universal context in which we labor. Because it is arduous, difficult to justify, must turn out eventually to have been no acceptance of the truth of nature, but a revolt against the mightier will of the Great Mother. So if we dampened that enthusiasm, that ardor to aspire towards this, however difficult, whether we're damming the torpedoes or risking everything for it, if we said no to it, we would be essentially shutting down the will of the Divine Mother within ourselves, who wants to work this out in nature. And if there is any higher light of illumined intuition or self-revealing truth, which is now in man either obstructed and inoperative, or works with intermittent glancings as if from behind a veil, with occasional displays as of the northern lights in our material skies, then there also we need not fear to aspire. For it is likely that such is the next higher state of consciousness, of which mind is only a form and veil, and through the splendors of that light may lie the path of our progressive self-enlargement into whatever highest state is humanity's ultimate resting place. I think his first chapter is so brilliant that it hardly needs commentary. You might like to know that when this book was first published in 1939, it was preceded by a number of months of work which Sri Aurobindo put into it. He had had an accident, you may know, to his right leg, and it had got broken in a fall on the early morning of the 24th of November in 1938. As soon as the situation was stabilized, Sri Aurobindo wanted to become active again, and by a happy arrangement, a request came from the Arya Publishing House in Calcutta that they would like to bring out one of Sri Aurobindo's books, and they would like to have The Life Divine. The mother was very happy about it and said yes, and encouraged him to do it. So he said he would. And he sat in his room with his right leg, the one that had been broken, stretched out upon a kind of a stool. And he wrote on large sheets of paper the corrections and things that he wanted to have placed. Now, there were a small number of attendees around Sri Aurobindo, Nirod Baran, Champaklal, etc. And Nirod, who had heard about how Sri Aurobindo had originally written the Arya, that he would simply sit in front of the typewriter and then eventually lift his fingers and start typing. And he would type, and when he would stop, he would just stand up and walk away. And people would come and look afterwards. It was looked like he was just typing something that he was seeing someplace, because it was a perfect flow, no interruption, and there were the sheets. And he hardly ever had to revise them. They basically went to the press with minor emendations made. So Nirod backed up and he watched to see how was Sri Aurobindo going to do this time. And he had not been present, you know, he came in the 20s. He wasn't there with Nalini in the earliest days. So he watched from a distance. And sure enough, Sri Aurobindo would take his pen. I think he had 3 pens and 2 pencils. And he would write. And he would start writing very calmly. And he would not stop. It would just be one continuous flow. And mother would come in with a drink of coconut water for him. And Sri Aurobindo would not be aware of her presence. And she would sit there smiling for a long time until finally, I think one of the attendants might come up and say, "Mother has brought your coconut water." And he would say, "Oh." He would place his pen down. And then he would be given the drink and he would take it. Nirod mentions that he perspired heavily. The only other time that he would stop is when his hands were wet, and he would reach and he would take a towel. And although he perspired heavily, there was never an odor at all. Completely clean, like fresh water falling from him. And in that way, he went through the Life Divine. And when the book came out in 1939, there were hundreds of copies brought to the ashram. You might remember, of course, that when the Life Divine began in 1914, it was almost with the commencement of the First World War. When the Life Divine appears as a book in 1939, it is with the commencement of the Second World War, because only months earlier, Germany had invaded Poland, and it was on. So this idea that all problems of life are essentially problems of harmony, that you have to get soul deep, you have to live in the greatest reality to solve these problems, you know. Again and again, Sri Aurobindo has an answer, but are we listening? Well, all of these copies were brought to the ashram. They were priced at 6 rupees. Now, in those days, of course, ashramites did not have any money, so many of them could not afford to buy a copy of the book. So some generous person offered 100 rupees and said, "Could these rupees be applied to the purchase of books for the disciples?" And Mother and Sri Aurobindo were very happy. And they took those copies and signed them. Sri Aurobindo signed those copies. The one that we have here was Kapali's. So interesting that we begin with a Vedic citation, and Kapali was a great Vedic scholar. It's so wonderful to have that book here. And Sri Aurobindo signed for each person. At some point, I think it became a tradition that the ashramites could have a copy of the books as they were published. So you can imagine how costly that was for the ashram, which did not have a lot of money. But everybody wanted to have it. Even if they were simple and couldn't understand English, they wanted to have the book because Sri Aurobindo had touched it and signed it. Mother would not let any published book leave the premises before she had seen at least the copies. She wanted to look at them and put her blessing upon them. She would touch them if she could. So all these books have had her touch. Then the books would go out. Sometimes they would receive them on a birthday or a darshan day. Mother would say, "Have you got this book?" And she would give it to them. If they asked especially, Sri Aurobindo would apply a signature. You can see how fine and small and perfect his signature is. Not like when he wrote his correspondence. You know, it's really quite good. Beautiful, in fact. Some people had very long names. I think Nirod notes, "Do I really have to write all that?" With blessings, Sri Aurobindo. And he continued up until the last years when his sight was going dim and he couldn't see anymore. And then it was made an end. But as long as he could see, he would sign. So, Well, I've chattered quite a bit tonight. Any questions that you have? Certainly, we'll have it go in the auspicious direction.
Are these also similar to that? They're very old, the other copies?
Yes, those are all signed copies of books, either by Mother or by Sri Aurobindo. So I'll be interested in your feedback about our manner of progress as we go through the Life Divine. I think the richness of the material Sri Aurobindo deserves better than a rough summary. So at least my current intention is to go through it line by line. Tonight, in whatever comments I made, they were of a general nature. But you can, I think, fear or expect that I will more greatly expatiate. Any comments or questions from our friends on Zoom? I think since we're still very close to the August 15th, could you give me the message up there? I'll read it again for those who haven't heard it. Thank you. Thank you very much. This is the message released on the 15th of August, which was the centenary of when the Life Divine made its first appearance in the Arya. In the mind, one may have a strong admiration or appreciation for the intellectual or spiritual greatness of the Guru, follow him, and mentally accept his dictates. But if it is merely mental, that does not carry you very far. Of course, there is no harm in having that also. But by itself, it does not open the whole of the inner being. It only establishes a mental contact. Psychic bhakti is not like that. Because it is in communication with the divinity behind, it is capable of true bhakti. Psychic bhakti does not make any demand. It makes no reservations. It is satisfied with its own existence. The psychic being knows how to obey the truth in the right way. It gives itself up truly to God or the Guru, and because it can give itself up truly, therefore it can also receive truly. Sri Aurobindo. So, until next time, namaste, jai ma, welcome to the Life Divine.